Hello, everyone, and welcome to Politics Aren't Boring, I Promise, where I, Serena Austin, a girl who happens to get a kick out of politics and who also happens to be president of Wilfrid Laurier University Student Publications, will do a bi-weekly breakdown of the top stories in Canadian politics with Laurier professors and community members. For our very first episode, we'll be talking about the Fed's new housing bill, the Nazi in the House of Commons, and what's really behind the anti-2S LGBTQ plus protests springing up around the nation. I think it makes sense to start our episode out with the most controversial issue on the list, so let's get into it. September 22nd was a big day in the Canadian House of Commons. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was invited to the House as a guest where he thanked Canada for their support in their fight against Russia over the last few years. Also invited to the House that day was 98-year-old Yaroslav Hanka, introduced as a World War II vet who fought against Russia for Ukraine's independence. If that introduction made you think back to your grade 10 history class, you're not alone. I spoke with Laurier political science and human rights professor Simon Kiss on just how a Nazi was allowed into the House of Commons.
There had been a state visit organized with President Zelensky of the Ukraine, and he was trying to drum up support for Ukrainian defense against Russian aggression. And part of the state visit was a speech to the House of Commons, which is something that is done. And the Speaker of the House of Commons was opening the session and, as his prerogative, introducing guests in his own gallery. And he introduced someone as a veteran of World War II, a Ukrainian-Canadian who had fought against the Russians in World War II. And initially, coverage was fine, and then it quickly emerged that the person that he'd introduced, he'd fought against the Russians with the Germans, making him effectively a volunteer Nazi. And all of a sudden, it looked very questionable. And the government of Canada suffered a huge embarrassment.
When I first heard about this, I think the headline didn't outright say, like, there was a Nazi in the House of Commons. It was kind of left up to the reader to, like, put two and two together. So I guess the question is it possible or feasible that the MPs in the House of Commons and even the House Speaker didn't know of this person's history?
Nobody really knows. So there's a reason that diplomatic events all look the same. It's because nobody likes any surprises. So you've seen diplomatic events where, you know, the two leaders, they are photographed sitting across from each other. They shake hands, they smile, they make chit chat, and then the media are asked to leave. And the reason everything is so controlled is to avoid embarrassments like this. Anytime diplomatic leaders, foreign leaders go on a tour to visit somewhere, there's a heavy, heavy emphasis on preparation and control on who they meet to avoid this kinds of things. So is it possible? I mean, sure, it is possible. So part of the issue is, though, those meetings, you know, the Speaker's office is independent from the government. He doesn't necessarily have a huge amount of staff that are focused on these kinds of things. He doesn't have the entire Foreign Affairs Ministry at his disposal.
Given that the House Speaker is independent, like in question period, there's been a lot of notion that Justin Trudeau specifically and like the Prime Minister's office should have had some responsibility in vetting this person, and that it's partially their fault that this occurred.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the accusation from the opposition. And nobody really knows. The government denies it. And we just don't know who knew. I mean, it's possible the Speaker's office simply made an oversight. You know, like I said, they're not as experienced in diplomacy in the same way that the Foreign Affairs Ministry, which ultimately would have been involved in all other aspects of this. On the other hand, it's also hard to believe in a way that the Speaker's office would not have circulated and or telegraphed to the Prime Minister's office who he had invited and what he would say. That's fairly standard practice. Either way, the government kind of comes off looking incompetent or sympathetic to a Nazi. There's no way you look good. I'm sort of inclined to believe that it falls more on the incompetent side than it does on the sympathetic to a Nazi side. World War II was 70 years ago, 80 years ago. Maybe it's easy to forget what the events were. And we're all so passionately supportive of Ukraine and Ukrainian independence that, you know, even experienced people sort of in the speaker's office or in the prime minister's entourage, you know, who hear, oh, there's a guest who fought against the Russians in World War II. Well, that's great. And they don't really know what the meaning of that is. I mean, maybe there's just a lack of historical knowledge. That would speak to incompetence.
Listening back to that clip this morning, I kind of felt like I could hear the moment when Anthony Rota may have realized like what was going on as he was introducing him. But speaking about incompetence, yeah, no one wants to believe that there are Nazi sympathizers in the House of Commons and that this was intentional. But if it is incompetence, what does that say about our government?
I mean, Canadians deserve a competent government. I mean, it's fair for citizens to expect a competent government. There's no question. And one of the government's jobs is to ensure that it conducts relations with other countries competently and reliably so that Canadian interests can be defended around the world. And there's no question that this was completely incompetent. I mean, you know, the government's incompetence made things harder for the government of the Ukraine. You know, they're fighting for their lives and the Ukraine is fighting for their independence. And that got harder because the initial premise of the invasion of the Ukraine was that it's kind of a Nazi regime. And lo and behold, Justin Trudeau basically made Vladimir Putin's point for him. He made it better than anybody could have. So people are right to be angry at the government, and the government deserves a kind of punishment.
Justin Trudeau, he's been facing a lot of heat, I think, in the political realm lately, especially from the leader of the opposition, Pierre Poilievre. And of course, there's been like a partisan spin taken on this issue that it's liberals' fault that this was allowed to happen. And there were calls for specifically Justin Trudeau to apologize, although, as we've said, the House Speaker is independent and has been said multiple times in question period all week that Anthony Rota has resigned and he has taken full responsibility for this. The Prime Minister's office had nothing to do with it. But of course, now Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has apologized on behalf of Parliament. Does it matter that he's apologized? Like, is that going to affect how people feel about this, do you think?
For sure. When you make a mistake, you should apologize. Canadians expect that. So yes, 100%. Will it matter? Nobody knows. I mean, you know, Doug Ford has apologized for trying to open up the green belt, and we'll see whether Ontarians will forgive him. So definitely apologizing helps. So you should do it rather than kind of sticking to your guns when you've done something wrong. You know, I can think of a few examples where Canadians have quote unquote forgiven governments, but I can think of times where they haven't. I mean, it looks like the government is getting a little long in the tooth, where, by which I mean it looks like things are kind of, the wheels are coming off the government and people are no longer are kind of going to want to kind of exert punishment on the government by throwing them out. But we'll see, you know, the election's a few years away. So they're probably the right to apologize, and people should do that more often. It's the right thing to do. It's impossible to predict whether it will get people out.
In question period from the Conservatives, there's a lot of the Liberal House Speaker attaching that Liberal position to him, although to my understanding, the House Speaker is independent, but he is a Liberal MP. Mm-hmm. What type of message do you think that sends to like the average person who's just tuning in?
The Conservatives are trying as best they can to pin this on the government. And that's their right to do so. And it's the right of the voters to sort of decide whether or not they accept that. Voters are going to get the government side that the speaker's independent, and they're going to get the conservative side that he's at some level part of the team, or at some level Trudeau is also responsible for this. And then it's up to each voter to basically decide which side they want to side with.
The reality is that the Nazi veteran who is in the House of Commons, Jaroslav Hanka, he was met with a standing ovation from all MPs who were in the House that day. Should they not all take some responsibility and apologize?
I mean, it would be hard to be an MP on the floor of the House of Commons and see everybody kind of standing up, giving a standing ovation, and not kind of go along with that. I mean, these are people. And, the speaker, who's your leader, has just kind of called on you to recognize his guest, right? It's his guest. And the speaker has asked you to stand up and acknowledge this person from his own riding. It's hard to then expect MPs to sort of say, well, wait, what? Who is this? Why? Like, that's a lot to weigh in the moment when cameras are rolling and everybody's watching and your two buddies next to you have gotten up. I don't know. I mean, basic psychology is leads me to be a bit forgiving there.
Yeah, no, that's totally fair. That's a fair outtake on that.
Next, I caught up with Jason Dean to talk about the housing crisis and the newly announced Bill C-56. Jason is a graduate of Laurier's BBA program and an assistant professor at King's University College at Western, where his research is focused on labor economics, housing, and immigrants and immigration.
Just to build some context, can you kind of like summarize what the housing situation is like in southwestern Ontario right now?
So the housing situation in Ontario is quite critical, in my opinion. Just to highlight the situation, Canada has 424 housing units per 1,000 residents, and that's well below the G7 average of 471. Not only that, Canada is expected to welcome approximately 1.5 million immigrants over the next 3 years. And so this really heightens the extent of the crisis. I think a lot of newcomers are going to have significant challenges finding a place to live. So just to give you a feel for the housing shortage in the Kitchener-Waterloo-Cambridge area, we can look at the housing starts that have occurred between 2010 and 2023 for single and semi-detached homes. And so in the Kitchener-Waterloo-Cambridge area, that was 14,124. Now, at the same time, so between that range, 2010 and 2023, the increase in the population, mainly due to immigration, was 113,000. So clearly, we're not able to keep up with the increase in immigration in terms of building new homes.
And so Justin Trudeau and Chrystia Freeland, the finance minister, they were in London, Ontario, which is another university town, to announce their introduction of Bill C-56, which is the Affordable Housing and Groceries Act, which on the housing piece is set to remove GST for new rental builds. And just off and off rip, what are your thoughts on that type of plan?
Well, first of all, yes, it's a very good idea. I mean, the issue we're having now is that the interest rates have increased substantially over the last few years. And so any company, that's deciding to increase construction of housing is going to face, substantially higher cost. And many of them would likely borrow money for the project. So you can imagine many of them now with these higher interest rates are perhaps going to find it not to be worthwhile because of these increased costs. So removing GST could certainly go a long way. However, the housing crisis that we're seeing right now was predictable many years ago. So this policy seems to be like a last minute political move when, if they were really serious about it, they would have been a little more preemptive and, started coming up with some policies many years ago.
Right. And even if that policy is implemented, it will still take some time for, those rental builds to actually be completed and to see a difference in our communities.
Yeah, that's a very important point. So again, it's over the next 3 years we're anticipating many newcomers to Canada, but it will likely take an equal number of years to build, even a fraction of the homes that could, sustain that need.
Initially, I sort of felt like the federal plan felt kind of similar to Doug Ford's plan of building in the Greenbelt with like a little bit of lack of
I guess, guarantee that any of this housing would actually be affordable or in places where people want to live. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, actually, that's a very good point. So in the federal, you know, the new bill, there's nothing in there that will guarantee any affordable housing. In fact, it probably won't lead to any affordable housing. There's nothing in it that stipulates, you know, any type of rent controls or anything like that. And also with the same thing for the provincial level. And, you know, I'm not entirely familiar with the details of the provincial plan. I am a little curious as to why there's a lot of land in Ontario. Why is there such a focus on the green belt, right? But again, like, the situation here was easily predictable years ago, and so it's really sad that the government could not be more proactive in this respect, because there's going to be a lot of serious issues.
I've heard, like, online and people who care about this issue advocating that the government just needs to fund the, like, building of affordable housing themselves, which previously was something that was done, like, before my lifetime. Is that feasible?
I think there's some issues here. I've heard a lot of arguments against having a specific building that's dedicated as, you know, affordable housing. You know, there could be all kinds of issues with that. There's some ideas where it's better to scatter the affordable housing in the general housing population, right? So, you know, just have maybe a certain fraction of different buildings with affordable housing. It's a subjective thing, right? It's definitely feasible for them to build, housing structures specifically dedicated towards affordable housing. But there are, you know, issues with that. And then there's issues with scattering it amongst, you know, regular market housing. So I'm not sure what the answer is, but we definitely need more housing. So I think, you know, we need to really, you know, work that out and do whatever it takes to get more housing.
And kind of on that note, other things that I'm hearing is that there's not going to be a be-all and end-all solution. It's going to be a mix of all of these things that we're talking about.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the big issue is seems to all be a little too late. It's not like we can build homes in a few weeks. So I'm not very optimistic. And it's important to note that the demographic changes are really important here. You know, even if we have the perfect economic incentives in place to, you know, incentivize lots of homes to be built very quickly, we have an issue of an aging population, a shrinking labor force. There's more people retiring than there are, you know, coming into the labor market. And so the question is, do we have enough labor to build these homes? I don't think so, given what I've seen. And there's also less, younger people going into the skilled trades as well. So that adds to the, you know, severity of this, which just makes it doesn't seem feasible at all that there is going to be any great solution anytime soon.
Another piece of that is the affordable housing and rent control, which Doug Ford removed when he came into office. And Justin Trudeau was criticized earlier this summer for saying that, like, housing is not really a federal issue. And in a way, he's sort of right. Rent control, stuff like that, does fall into provincial responsibility. But I don't know. It has to be someone's issue, right?
Well, I mean, there's nothing stopping the federal government from, you know, providing funding and providing economic incentives for housing, like they just did. They reduced the GST. So there's one example. There could be many other roles that the federal government could play. I mean, we're not going to hear them admit that they didn't bother to plan for this. So, you know, we'll never get a clear answer from them. But I think it's very clear that this, you know, demographics are very predictable. You know, you can look at an age pyramid in any given year and sort of predict what it's going to be in the following years. It's very straightforward. And none of this was done.
Yeah, it's a sticky situation. And then to sort of just localize it a bit more, when we're talking about these university towns, I don't know that many universities are building specific residences. At least in Waterloo, I see a lot of the student residences, they are privately owned. They're like property management groups that own multiple buildings. They don't have great reviews. Students aren't living in like the best places, but they're super expensive. And so I think, I'm obviously no expert, but that universities committing to building new housing for students specifically would not only take the stress off of their students having to find housing, but also take the stress off of regular year-long residents in those towns who are trying to find housing for their families.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, that's an important point. I mean, I guess the one of the issues that's been in the news lately is the international students. Now, many universities rely heavily on the revenue from international students and, you know, to a very large extent. And so it does make sense for them to, you know, build, you know, adequate student residence, adequate student housing for them. And especially if they believe that, you know, this is going to be a long-term, you know, source of revenue. I'm not sure why that hasn't been done. A lot of things happened very quickly. We had, you know, COVID and you know, lots of complications there. It's kind of a catch-22 in a sense. If there's no housing for international students, then they don't, you know, there's going to be less that are going to be here and contributing to the revenues. And then, but if the university doesn't have the revenues, then how, you know, they're not going to be able to afford the housing. Right. So this is, again, another sticky situation, but, you know, it definitely needs to be addressed. And there could perhaps be some, you know, I think what we're missing too, not only the timing of these policies aren't very good, I don't see any well thought out, clever and innovative policies as well. You know, just think, you know, maybe there could be some kind of subsidies for people to rent out part of their homes. That would maybe be a very quick way to at least alleviate some of it, right? If you provide enough incentive, you know, people who are living in homes who, you know, maybe aren't using the basement or something like that, if you could incentivize that and you can quickly convert those into housing for students. I think, yeah, we really need to think about some clever and timely solutions if possible.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Just hearing my peers around me trying to find housing in the way that things are right now, it's really ridiculous.
And it is interesting because, you know, economically there's money to be made in providing that housing. So to me, there must be some, you know, there's some type of bottleneck here that's preventing it, right? If you can get these high rents and make money off housing, then why, you know, normally the market would supply that, you know, people want to make money. So it really shows you there must be a lot of significant government regulations and other non-market forces here that are preventing this from happening. That's another, I guess, another important point too is, you know, we've had substantial increases in housing. Like the London area, it's more than doubled in, or yeah, probably more than doubled in maybe 5 years. So there's a lot of profit to be made in building homes. So why isn't the market stepping up? So they removed the GST, but there's also municipal considerations as well as provincial and federal, right? What's really the bottleneck here and how can we incentivize more homes with less regulations, but still ensure safety? You don't want them building unsafe homes or low quality homes. It's not what we're looking for.
Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely a lot more to learn and like uncover in this area. And I know you've mentioned a few things that could potentially be part of the solution. But are there any politicians that you're aware of or any geographical regions that you believe are tackling this issue right?
That's a very good question. Unfortunately, I don't. I haven't heard of any smart policies or anything to address these issues that I'm aware of. If there are some of these, well, they need to be made more public, and we should be trying to, our politicians that aren't implementing these new innovative ideas should definitely be aware of them. You know, that perhaps we should look at other countries as well in Europe mm-hmm. and other parts of the world where they may have faced these types of issues. How are they dealing with it? Certainly in the United States, they're facing similar demographic issues. So, you know, I'm sure there's some minor issues with, you know, some of these, you know, with the aging population and, you know, there might be some shortages there as well, but I don't know, you don't seem to hear about it being such an issue. Maybe they're doing something that we could learn from them. I think that's something to look into as well. That's a good point.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for doing this interview with me. Before we wrap up, is there anything else that you think I or our listeners should know about the topic?
I mean, the key message is, you know, we have a large amount of people that are going to be, you know, immigrating to Canada, but we're not going to be able to, you know, accommodate them well in terms of housing and healthcare. And it's very important that we have immigration, you know, to help offset the aging population. Yeah. So if we, you know, make it so that they don't want to come here anymore, that's not going to be a very smart thing, right? That'll cost us a lot. So we really need to think about how to best address this, and the time is critical, and yeah, we need some smart policies.
Our last issue for this episode takes a deeper look at the rise of anti-2S LGBTQ+ hate, the Million March for Children protests that took place around the nation, and how it's affecting school-age children. For this, I spoke to Carolyn Fitzgerald, a professor in Laurier's Faculty of Education, who helped develop a whole suite of equity and diversity courses for the faculty.
I think what's actually going on is actually still in the process of unfolding. I don't think it's entirely clear yet. You know, in a broader context, there has been a somewhat vocal group who is advocating for a greater level of, I would maybe call it social conservatism. So, you know, we've seen that in the move to limit drag queen story times in libraries. And I think most recently that has focused on limiting expression, discussion, exposure to ideas related to gender identity. And that's really, unfortunately, taken hold. We've seen in other places in Canada, in particular in New Brunswick and Saskatchewan, in which, you know, I think, although politicians should perhaps listen to a majority voice, politicians, unfortunately, sometimes listen to a loud voice. And this is a group of people who may be very small, but are particularly loud and vocal. And so, you know, that's resulted in a move to curtail and control the freedoms related to gender identity in a school classroom. So specifically, we've seen some legislation in New Brunswick and Saskatchewan to require a teacher to expose the gender identity requests to any child under the age of 16, so child and youth, who ask for to be called by anything other than their assigned name at birth, or to be referred to by any other pronoun to which they were assigned by their parents. I'm alarmed by this. I'm extremely alarmed by this for lots and lots of different reasons, which I'm sure we'll get into.
And when you say it's still unfolding, I think I can attest to kind of witnessing that myself. I feel like for months, and I don't want to conclusively put a timeline on this, but I feel like since the kind of unraveling of the whole freedom convoy in Ottawa, oftentimes when I am just scrolling on TikTok, I will come across several live streams that are at the scene from whichever side of usually like those drag queen protesting the drag queen readings at libraries and stuff like that, like just very mundane things. And it's people like in parking lots screaming at each other with their F. Trudeau flags. And it is alarming. And even here in like Kitchener-Waterloo, after these protests were happening, there's been at a school a LGBTQ flag taken taken down and stomped on and lit on fire. So even though it may be like a small group of people, their actions and their words and what they're supposedly protesting against, it does have real consequences.
Well, I'm glad you made the connections to the way in which the people in Ottawa were terrorized by this group of protesters just in a really horrific way, because I think there is a connection here. You know, certainly when I've watched some of the protesters related to this, I'm also seeing lots of anti-vax signs and, as you said, the F. Trudeau signs. And so there is a connection. And I, in fact, I read about an effort to mobilize a group of vehicles to take over Queen's Park in Toronto in protest of teaching students about gender identity in a school setting. Fortunately, that never materialized. But the fact that the same tactic was being employed is really interesting to me. And so I think that's really important to keep in mind, that I don't believe this is just about gender identity. I do believe this is about a greater effort by this small group of fringe people to push for more social conservatism. The other thing that I think is a clever, if not scary, piece of marketing is the idea that this is about children's safety. Because in my view, this is the very opposite. This is creating conditions that are actually making things very unsafe for children at school, especially kids who are part of the queer community or might identify as part of the queer community. You know, we have seen certainly a number of hate-related incidences at school related to Pride flag, and we know that students who identify as part of the queer community or in the queer spectrum have reported greater feelings of discomfort and feelings of lack of safety at school than ever before. So this is absolutely not about keeping our children safe. This is about the very opposite. And we only need to look to the states to sort of see the progression of events here. You know, if I look at what happened in Florida with DeSantos, so DeSantos, you know, first started to pass legislation that really challenged the safety and the ability to exist openly and comfortably in a school setting for queer kids. And then he went after critical race theory and teaching about Black history. And more recently, he's passed legislation that makes it very difficult for some immigrants to get healthcare, access to education, to work in Florida. And it's no surprise to me that there's been this progression of events. And I think, in my view, when we legislate hate, and I believe that's what has happened in New Brunswick and Saskatchewan, when we legislate hate, we give permission for other people to act in hateful ways. So it is also not a coincidence, in my view, that we're seeing these, we're hearing these voices in Canada, and then all of a sudden we have a group of parents in British Columbia who advertise a whites-only playgroup. And I think we really, in analyzing and kind of understanding what's going on here, we really have to think about how hatred and discrimination disadvantages every single one of us. So when we teach kids that it's not okay to be part of a minority or a marginalized group or indifferent in any way, what comes next? Is it kids who wear a hijab to school? And I don't even think that's next, because I think it's already happening. But or people who wear a turban, or people who have any other kind of visual difference, right? We're teaching children about discrimination.
I can see how a message like leave our kids alone is like, yeah, I leave the kids alone. But if that's as far as you look into it, I don't think a lot of people are aware, like, as you say, it's not just about gender identity. You think there are a whole bunch of other things that people are supposedly fighting for behind this movement, and leave our kids alone is like a very easy thing to get behind. But, and not to go back to TikTok, but I've seen racialized families like putting their kids on TikTok, having them like stand behind them while they make their speech about why the kids should be left alone, and then like encouraging their kids to share the message too. And like, as you just listen to what the kids are saying, it's very obvious that they don't know what they're talking about. They don't understand what they are supposedly fighting for. And it doesn't entirely seem that their parents do either. And it's concerning to me that, because why wouldn't they come for you next? Why wouldn't they turn on you next? So I think that is a really important part to consider for anyone who is like who is struggling to see what could be wrong about the messaging of kids alone.
This is a time when we all, for those of us who are really concerned about, and I think this is true of the majority of Canadians, but for those of us who really want to see an inclusive, kind, caring society, we need to amplify our voices, right? We need to ensure that our voices are equally, if not louder, and don't get lost here. You know, one difference that I might point out that I think is important to consider, though, is that people in the queer community, we can sometimes be part of an invisible minority, right? It's not always obvious to others that we are part of the queer community. And the other piece, though, is most of us, the majority of us, we don't necessarily share that identity with our parents.
Right.
And so students who might be questioning, might be exploring, might have determined that they are part of the queer community, be that through their sexual orientation identity or their gender identity or any other aspect of their identity, they probably don't share that with their parents. They might in some circumstances, but they probably don't. And so, you know, to decide that a teacher should be the person who determines if and when a parent should know about that is highly problematic. You know, most of us are in the situation where we have to educate our parents about what it means to have a queer identity. And that can take a lot of time. It can happen very slowly. It doesn't always happen. And it's really important that we are in charge of when, where, and how that happens. I have a number of friends. Now, I'm old, obviously a lot older than kids in the current school system. I have a number of friends, though, who were kicked out of their home as young teenagers when they identified as gay or lesbian to their parents. Is that in the best interest of our students? I don't think so. If we pass legislation that says a teacher has to report this to parents, has to be the police in the classroom and report this to parents, then we take that safety and control away from our young people. So, you know, when this group talks about making things safer for children, safer for which children?
I think a lot of the argument on the protesting parents' side is that parents know best. Children wouldn't have any idea of their gender or sexual identity at whatever age. I'm not sure, because we're talking both elementary and high school, so that notion to me is just ridiculous, because I have friends who tried to come out in elementary and high school and it wasn't received well, and now as adults they've had to distance themselves from the people and now thankfully are able to be out. But it's just kind of ridiculous to think that kids aren't aware of that. And then when you say, like, who are we protecting? What are we protecting our kids from? It seems to me that those parents are trying to protect their kids from literally just ideology, just the fact and the exist that there are people, there are 2S LGBTQ plus people who exist, and the idea that your parent might know best, if that parent is one of those ones who were violently protesting, how could you even imagine that if your child was queer, they would be able to come to you?
Really, what they're saying is it's only acceptable for children and youth to identify as cisgendered and queer.
Exactly.
So let's call it what it is, because everybody has a gender identity. Everybody has a sexual orientation. It can change over time, but everybody has one. So really what's being said here is it's only acceptable to identify as straight and cisgendered. And what's the next step for those parents? Are you looking for an opportunity to throw your child into conversion therapy, right? I mean, we've made that an illegal practice in Canada because we fully understand how dangerous and harmful that and abusive that practice is. But I have to question if that's the opportunity such a parent is looking for.
I feel like it's kind of important to bring up that the legal action that we've been seeing in New Brunswick and Saskatchewan about this, it's not like reactionary. Like there was no proposed movement and then the government is saying, no, actually, we don't think that should be allowed. This is like these practices have been going on in schools for as long as I can remember. And so it seems like social regression to me.
I think that's a really good way of framing it is these parents are trying to, or this group is trying to convince the general public that a problem exists where one does not. This is not a problem that exists. So it's creating an issue that simply has not been in schools. You know, when I think of the Ontario context, we've had a very clear plan and statements about equity and diversity in our Ontario schools since 2014. This has not been a problem in our schools.
To kind of talk more about the legal side of this issue, now the Saskatchewan Premier, Scott Moe, is looking to invoke the notwithstanding clause, which basically allow Saskatchewan's provincial government to override some parts of the Canadian Charter in order to, I don't know, achieve their political goals. And in this sense, it is to force teachers to have to basically out their students to their parents. So why do you think that some politicians are trying to fight so hard for this issue?
It's a great question. I've heard the notwithstanding clause described as the nuclear option. And I think that's a pretty good way of describing it. You know, I've kind of laughingly said, you know, when I sometimes get frustrated about our voting options in the political sphere, could we not just make it a basic requirement that if you're going to run for office, you should uphold the Charter of Human Rights and Freedom? That doesn't seem like a big ask to me. However, apparently it is for some. And I don't know if you're familiar with the there was a judge, a provincial judge in Saskatchewan who ruled that there needed to be a pause on this effort to require teachers to out and police students in their classroom. And in her statement, one of the things she noted was that the Saskatchewan government had failed to demonstrate that this was a widespread, broad issue of great concern. In fact, the judge noted that the Saskatchewan government only showed evidence of 18 letters from parents, or sorry, from people who wanted parent or teachers to police their students in this way, and only 7 of those letters were from people with school-age children. Okay. Now, I'm not so naive to think there's only 18 people in Saskatchewan who, you know, are supporting what the premier is trying to do. I'm not that naive. I believe there's more. Nevertheless, I think that's a really clear example that there are times when, you know, obviously there are people with extreme social conservative values, And some of them occasionally are going to get into office. And I think that's what's happening in Saskatchewan. Other times, I think the politician is listening to that loud voice rather than the majority voice. But I think there are times when that extreme social conservative gets into power. And I think that's a really good example of that in Saskatchewan. And I think, you know, frankly, all Canadians should be invested in seeing that the Charter of Human Rights and Freedom is upheld. Because if you ever read it, I think every single Canadian will see a way in which their rights, their needs are protected in that charter. So once we limit that, every single Canadian is vulnerable here.
Absolutely. That is great advice. And the charter is easily accessible online.
Yes.
There are people listening who haven't ever had a chance to look at it. As you've said in the beginning, this is still unfolding. The announcement about the notwithstanding clause is very recent, so we'll have to see how that goes in Saskatchewan. But what are your final thoughts that you would like to share to our listeners?
I think if I had one final thought, it might be that at all times and every time, the primary responsibility of a teacher should be to the safety and well-being of a child in their care and in their classroom. And that commitment to the safety and well-being of the child needs to be first, foremost, and unwavering. And I think if when we think about this logically with more information, we can see that these efforts are very much against the safety and best interest of any individual child. And we need to ensure and support our teachers in their duty of care towards our students.
Well, thank you so much, Carolyn. I really enjoyed listening to your thoughts on this, and I hope our listeners do as well.
That's all for this episode. Thanks for tuning in. My name is Serena Austin, and I'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode of Politics Aren't Boring, I promise.